A chill wind blows on a black night. The place, Washington, D.C., the capital of a divided nation. It has been a rain-filled April. Pennsylvania Avenue is awash with mud and muck. The city sleeps, but it's a mournful sleep. One of those who mourns is the wife of the President of the United States. Abraham Lincoln has been assassinated. This week, we observe the 100th anniversary of the death of Abraham Lincoln. So let us go back 100 years and relive those days. Let us meet the people who walked in the shadow of Lincoln. Some who loved him, some who hated him. Tonight, 100 years ago, President Lincoln was living out the last evening of his mortal life. The conspirators had made their plans. The moment to strike was at hand. These are the last days of Lincoln.
The Last Days of Lincoln. This five-part series is brought to you by the Lincoln National Life Insurance Company of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and your Lincoln Life General Agents in the Twin Cities, Lynn M. Elling and Associates of Minneapolis, James J. Sheehan and Associates, St. Paul, and by Twin City Federal, headquarters for savings accounts, home loans, and home improvement loans. Now, 100 years ago tonight, the last days of Lincoln.
One 100 years ago on this day, it was Good Friday, April 14th. The capital of Washington, D.C. was observing the day on which our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, had died. It was a solemn day from dawn onward. In the Catholic churches, such as St. Patrick's and St. Aloysius, the statuary and the Stations of the Cross were hung in purple. It was the last full day of Lent, and the first day on which the Civil War would be referred to in the past tense. The Great War was over, and the capital, like other cities in the North, lay quiet and exhausted after a full 12 days of celebrating. Little did the town know that while celebrating the death of Christendom's greatest martyr, the day would end with the creation of another martyr, Abraham Lincoln. April 14th, 1865. Official Washington stretched its legs and moved its creaking joints at about 7:30 that morning. Carriages began rumbling up the streets, and government workers began heading for their jobs, heads aching, stomachs queasy, but with a full day of work ahead. President Lincoln was in his office at this hour, sitting at a small table, reading official correspondence. Across the street from the White House, on the east side of Lafayette Square, the oldest man in the cabinet was enjoying his morning shave as he lay in his bed. Secretary of State William H. Seward, nearly 64 now, had been in bed for many days, ever since he was disabled by a carriage accident. On K Street, opposite Franklin Square, the Secretary of War, flint-jawed Edwin McMaster Stanton, dawdled over a breakfast of soft-boiled eggs. On the other side of town, an actor named John Wilkes Booth crawled out of bed and washed in a basin of cold water in the corner of the room. He had a lot on his mind. A friend of his, George Atzerodt, was snarling under the covers of his bed in a room at the Kirkwood House. He was wondering whether his head would hold still long enough for him to climb out of bed and begin the day. Down in the Navy Yard section, young Davy Harold sat on the edge of his bed, trying to remember what it was he had to do for John Wilkes today. At the Herndon House on 9th Street, the big bull, Lewis Payne, slept late, content in knowing that his past experiences as an ex-Confederate soldier would help see him through the strange duties which John Wilkes had laid out for him, duties that would be taken care of before the fall of night that day. By 8 in the morning on this, the last full day of his life, the president sat down to breakfast with his family. He was a lean eater. He usually ate one egg and drank one cup of coffee at his morning meal. Gathered round were his wife, Mary, his 21-year-old son, Robert, and his younger son, Tad.
Just for memories, Father, with the war over and done with, I have this small memento for you.
Well, now, let's see what it is. I'll open it up. See here, Mother. Robert's given me a picture of Robert E. Lee. Huh. It's a good face. I'm glad the war is over at last.
Abe, I thought we'd go to Grover's tonight and see the celebration and fireworks. But on second thought, I've made up my mind. We'll go to Ford's Theater and take the Grants with us. Robert, can you use these tickets to Grover's?
Oh, I think not. You see, I've already made plans to spend the evening with some of my friends.
Now, Mother, if you want to go to Ford's tonight and see Laura Keene, that's what we'll do. But I can't promise you about General Grant and his wife. But I'll get the tickets and see what I can do. After all, Grant is a great hero, and the people are entitled to see him.
By 9 that morning, April 14th, 1865, President Lincoln was back in his office. There was business to be taken care of, visitors and petitioners to see, and there was a cabinet meeting, too. Lincoln signed 2 documents and nodded to the soldier standing inside the double door to admit the first visitor. It was Schuyler Colfax, the Speaker of the House.
Ah, Mr. Colfax, it's good to see you as always. And what can I do for you on this Good Friday morning?
Thank you, President Lincoln. I'd like to talk to you about 2 different matters. First of all, what with all the talk about Reconstruction and whatnot, I kind of figured you'd be looking at some possible changes in the cabinet. I mean, not all of the men have stuck with you through lean times and fat times as I have.
Well, that may be true, Mr. Colfax, but I suggest maybe we can cross that bridge when we come to it.
Well, now, don't get me wrong, Abe. I just thought it would be best for all concerned if I laid it right on the line. I mean, after all, it's not as though I don't have the necessary experience to help you on the cabinet level.
Mm-hmm. And what else is on your mind, Mr. Colfax?
Oh, yes. Well, now, some of the members of the House, myself included, I might add, have been hearing rumors that you're about to undertake the reconstruction of the South without letting the House speak its piece on the subject. Do you plan to call a special session of Congress so that you might learn its views on the matter?
I have no intention at the moment of calling a special session, and if I change my mind, I'll give the due 60 days' notice.
This day, 100 years ago, an unnatural quiet overtook the capital of Washington. Most government employees had quit work for the day. No church bells sounded. Few pedestrians were on the streets. In the White House, President Lincoln met with members of his cabinet. The subject, Reconstruction of the South. It would be the last cabinet meeting ever attended by Abraham Lincoln. In little more than 10 hours from now, he would be mortally wounded. Outside the Treasury building, a lone horse and buggy pulled away on the cobblestones, guided by James R. Ford, the operator of the Ford Opera House. The buggy was laden with flags for decorating the president's box. Approaching E Street, he spied a friend of his, one of his actors, John Wilkes Booth.
Well there, girl. John Wilkes, out for a Good Friday stroll.
Anything to ease the burden of a dull day.
Well, it may be dull at the moment, but I'll have a busy time of it tonight. The House is sure to be a sellout, what with Lincoln and Grant and the presidential box.
Well, I might stop down for a bit, although I've no real desire to see Red Laura in The American Cousin.
Well, stop by if you get the chance, Booth. Who knows? I may even let you in free, just for old time's sake.
The hour is now 1 o'clock in the afternoon, April 14th, 100 years ago today. Booth and his fellow conspirators can simply let the hours slide by, awaiting this evening when their work will begin. But for the President, Abraham Lincoln, this hour finds him still in the midst of the cabinet meeting. He is a minority political leader now. The entire South opposed him. The Northern Democrats opposed him. The radicals in his own Republican Party opposed him. But there is work to be done. The South, disenfranchised, must be returned to the Union. The great Reconstruction lies ahead. This cabinet meeting goes smoothly. On most issues, Lincoln's will prevails. Outside the cabinet meeting, on the issues of whether he will live another 24 hours, Lincoln's will does not prevail. The hours pass by, and by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 100 years ago, the city of Washington turned back into life. The wooden walks bustled with women, their full skirts bobbing with every step. Buggies, surreys, and gigs fought for position in the avenue. The bars were crowded again. Restaurants were doing a good business. At that hour, President Lincoln finished his work. Mrs. Lincoln wanted to go for a carriage ride, and they did. President Lincoln was in rare humor on this, his last carriage ride. Lighthearted laughter pealed from the presidential carriage.
You know, Abe, dear, you almost startle me by your cheerfulness.
And well, I may feel so. Mother, I consider that this day the war has come to a close. We must both be cheerful in the future. Between the war and the loss of Willie, we have both been very miserable. Let me say, I don't believe I've ever felt so happy in my life.
Supper time arrived in the capital of Washington, and at 6 o'clock on this night, 100 years ago, Lincoln's remaining lifespan could be counted in hours. A warm breeze laced the city as the supper lull set in. But John Wilkes Booth was a busy man at this hour. The actor made another visit to Ford's Theater. He treated the stagehands to a bottle at Tattable's Tavern next door. Leaving them at the saloon, Booth returned to the theater. He headed for the front of the theater, took the way from the dress circle to the state box. He had a penknife. Using the knife, he whittled a small hole in the thin wooded door leading to the box. Then he took a board and tested it to see whether by carving out a small section of plaster wall, he could use the board to jam shut the door leading from the dress circle to the box area. It worked. Booth picked up the wood and plaster shavings in a handkerchief. Then he walked into the state box and leaned over the railing. 11 feet below was the stage, and Booth knew he would make that leap tonight. A leap onto the stage and into history. It is an hour later, 7 o'clock on this night, 100 years ago. The city prepares for a gala night. Ball gowns are taken from closets and stiff, starched collars are examined with mistrusting glances by tired husbands. In the White House, William H. Crook stands outside the door of the president's office. He's an efficient officer. He's working overtime at the moment because his relief, John F. Parker, has not shown up yet for work. Parker is 3 hours late. It had happened before. In fact, Parker is a shiftless officer, and everyone in the department knows it. But he is Lincoln's personal bodyguard on this deadly evening. By 8 o'clock, John Wilkes Booth is back in his room at the National Hotel, arming himself with the accoutrements of a criminal.
First, the pistol, the trusty Derringer. We load it with one shot, a good-sized lead ball, and we put in the percussion cap so that our little beauty may speak. Ah, and the knife. The sheathed knife goes into one's waistband so as to not hinder the actor's movements. And, of course, the false beard, the dark mustache, the wig, even a muffler. And, if we need them, 2 large revolvers.
John Wilkes Booth, after a full day of drinking and plotting, is beginning to sober up now, and he is becoming confident. His manner shows it. He leaves his room, enters the lobby, and passes by the desk.
Are you going to Ford's Theater this evening, clerk?
Well, really, I hadn't thought of it.
Ah, you should. You'll see some fine, rare acting this evening.
At that same hour, 8 o'clock, Mary Lincoln stands in a White House room wearing a pretty bonnet with tiny flowers and a low-necked white dress.
Abe, do hurry. Would you have us be late?
Mother, I'm moving as fast as these long legs will allow. All this last-minute business has put me off schedule. You go on down. I'll see you at the carriage.
All right, Abe, but do hurry. We still must stop by for our guests, and I don't want to be late.
The guests of the Lincolns tonight are Miss Harris and Major Rathbone, who had stepped into the breach when Grant, Stanton, and other invited guests bowed out of the evening. 2 cavalrymen ride behind the presidential carriage as it winds its way through the Capitol streets. The carriage arrives at Ford's Theater at 8:25 on this night, 100 years ago. John Parker, the president's personal guard, has finally shown up for work. He checks the premises and escorts the president, the first lady, and their guests to the state box overlooking the stage. The play, Our American Cousin, is already underway, and Laura Keene, cast as Florence Trenchard, is speaking her lines.
Good gracious. You have almost a game of draughts. What is the matter?
That was a joke, that wolf. The draft has been suspended.
I can't see the joke.
Anybody can see that.
The two actors on stage were engaged in some political ad-libbing as the presidential party made itself comfortable. The play stopped at that point. The band struck up Hail to the Chief, finished it with a flourish. The audience stood, sat down again, and the play resumed. At the door, leading to the presidential box, Lincoln's personal guard, John Parker, sat in a chair. But he got bored. At 9 o'clock on this evening, 100 years ago, John Parker pushed his chair aside and walked out of the theater. Minutes later, he was enjoying a glass of ale with Francis Burns, the driver of the presidential carriage. In the theater, President Lincoln sat in a red velvet chair. He took hold of Mary's hand as the play moved on.
Abe, what will Miss Harris think of my hanging on to you so?
Why, Mother, she'll think nothing about it.
These were the last words ever spoken by the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, this night, 100 years ago.
A penny for a good thought. And here's something well worth considering whenever a Lincoln penny passes through your fingers. You may not be able to save enough from your salary to provide for a comfortable retirement in later life, but chances are you can afford a Lincoln Life Insurance policy that will give you a liberal retirement income. The cost is mere pennies a day if you start early enough. The first thing to do is obtain the full story from Lincoln Life. Just write to Lincoln Life, in care of WCCO Radio, Minneapolis or St. Paul, including your name, date of birth, and address. Absolutely no cost, no obligation. Matter of fact, you'll also receive a wonderful free gift from Lincoln Life, a color picture of Abraham Lincoln, suitable for framing, plus a copy of the Gettysburg Address on parchment paper in Lincoln's handwriting. Retirement plan details, plus the special gifts, also are available from Lincoln Life's general agents, Lynn M. Elling and Associates in Minneapolis, James J. Sheehan and Associates, St. Paul.
The hands on the clocks in Washington edged forward. Inside Ford's Theater, an audience of 1,600 enjoy a humorous play. Outside Ford's Theater, a sure-footed mare picks her way lightly through the dark alley at the rear of the building. The horse approaches the single light that burns at the stage door, and her rider holds the reins forward and waits. Astride the horse, an actor, a villain. It is John Wilkes Booth. He enters the theater, removes his gloves, bows, smiles, and talks easily to fellow actors in the wings. On stage, the play moves forward. In the presidential box, overlooking the stage, four figures, nearly hidden in shadows, watch and listen as the actors speak their lines. Booth has plenty of time. It'll be 45 minutes before the play reaches the point where he will strike. He leaves the building and goes next door to Tattable's bar. The owner, Peter Tattable, approaches the actor from behind the bar.
Well, it'll be tonight, John. I kind of thought you'd be next door at the show.
No, Peter, but I may take in the last act or two. Give me a bottle of whiskey and some water.
What's the matter, John? Changing your taste? I thought you were strictly a brandy man.
Not tonight. Tonight, Peter, I'm going to need something stronger.
Booth drinks, keeps his eye on the time, and then makes ready to leave the saloon. A voice sounds from farther down the bar.
Say, aren't you that actor fella, John Wilkes Booth?
Yes, I am.
Well, then, let me drink to you. Say, but let me tell you something. You'll never be the actor your father was.
My friend, when I leave the stage, I will be the most famous man in America.
On this night, 100 years ago, the moon was due to rise slightly after 10 o'clock. And almost as if upon signal, the clouds cleared away over the city of Washington when the clock struck 10. It was a beautiful spring night. A night to be out doing things. And that's exactly what was happening. In less than a half hour, Abraham Lincoln would be dying, and several men would be running. Inside the theater, the second scene of the third act had begun. The play was moving to a close, as was one of history's greatest crimes. But other men were afoot besides John Wilkes Booth. Among them, Lewis Payne, the big, bullish ex-Confederate soldier, and Dave Harold, alert and enthusiastic, but a young and foolish man. At 10 past 10, Booth had returned to Ford's Theater, but Payne and Harold were preparing to carry out their part of the plot, to assassinate the Secretary of State, William H. Seward.
Now, Lewis, there's going to be no trouble. We'll just do as Mr. Booth says. Seward has been sick as a dog ever since that carriage spill. Uh-huh. You take this medicine, tell the servant it's for Seward, and take it to him.
Uh-huh.
Then do as you've been told. Kill him. I'll wait outside with the horses.
Well, all right, then. Let's go, but don't run out on me now.
Yes. What can I do for you, sir?
I've got this bottle of medicine for Mr. Seward. His doctor sent me from the store and told me I've got to give it to him personally.
Well, I'm afraid you can't do that, sir. Mr. Seward's asleep now. And if you got any medicine, you can give it to me, and I'll see that he gets it.
But I'm under strict orders to give it to him personally, and I...
Say there! What's going on down there, Bell? Who's there? What does the gentleman want?
Well, I told him, sir, that he can't give this medicine to your father in person, but he insists.
Out of my way. I'll go up and talk to him.
Now, sir, if you've got medicine for my father, I'll gladly see that he gets it. But I'm afraid you won't be able to go into his room. Now, you go back and tell the doctor that I refuse to let you see him. I am Mr. Seward, and I'm in charge here. He won't blame you if you tell him I refuse to let you see him.
Well, very well, then. I'll go.
But the big, lumbering conspirator did not go. He turned and lunged at young Seward, pulling a pistol at the same time. The hammer clicked. The gun did not fire. And he leaped upon Seward like a madman. Using the butt of the useless gun, he whipped Seward over the head and neck again and again. During the struggle, the servant was out into the street like a shot, shouting for help. Big, brutal Payne could not be stopped now. He left young Seward in a bleeding trance at the top of the stairs and slammed his way into the bedroom of the Secretary of State. Payne drew his knife and attacked a figure on the bed.
There you are.
Payne struck with his knife again and again, and then was finally pulled off the bed by two figures in the darkened room. He swung his knife wildly, heard screams of pain from his attackers, and then returned to the figure on the bed. Seward had fallen to the floor, and Payne was atop him again, trying to finish the job. And then he stormed out of the room and ran headlong into two other people. One was a young woman. The other was a State Department messenger.
What's going on?
Payne plunged his blade into the man's chest up to the hilt, then sprang down the steps and into the street. The woman fainted, and Payne had left a picture of carnage in his wake. Payne arrived on the street. He found David Harold nowhere to be seen. Calmly, he untied his horse and rode away slowly, while a short distance behind him, the servant trotted along, crying for help. Nobody paid any attention, and Lewis Payne rode off, confident that he had done his job. There was more work to be done. What about George Atzerodt, the drunken Prussian assigned by Booth to the task of slaying the vice president, Andrew Johnson? Even as Lincoln's killer was now on the hunt, Johnson's killer was not. With the hour past 10 o'clock on this night 100 years ago, George Atzerodt trotted his horse up 10th Street, past Ford's Theater. Atzerodt knew this would be a night for history, and the thought made him glance at the theater. Faint sounds of laughter echoed out onto the street, and George could almost feel Booth lurking within. That gave him determination to carry out his end of the plot. He turned his horse and headed for the Kirkwood House, where the vice president had his room. But there, his determination ended. The carriage maker from Port Tobacco admitted to himself that he was a drunken coward, and he walked into a bar. There, George Atzerodt tried to drink his worries away, even as John Wilkes Booth was going into action. The wavy-haired actor, whose name would go down in history as an infamous killer, had now thoroughly checked the theater. On the stage, the play continued.
Ah, Mr. Trenchard, we were just talking of your archery powers.
Well, I guess shooting with bows and arrows is just about like most things in life.
All you have got to do is keep the sun out of your eyes, look straight, pull strong, calculate the distance, and you're sure to hit the mark in most things as well as shooting.
In the dress circle on this night, 100 years ago, a man and a little girl were disappointed. James Ferguson, restaurateur, had gotten tickets for the play just so that he and his niece could get a glimpse of President Lincoln and General Grant.
Oh, well, now, look here now. Who's that gentleman coming down the right aisle there? See, it's pretty dark to get a good look at him.
Is it the general? Is it really General Grant?
No, girl, I'm afraid not. There, see him there now. That's just the actor, John Wilkes Booth. You've seen him before.
Oh, yes. Isn't he handsome?
John Wilkes, handsome though he was, had an ugly heart at that hour on this night 100 years ago. The clock edged forward. Lincoln's conscious life remaining could be counted in seconds now. The play ground slowly forward to the point where Booth had made up his mind he would fire the shot that would send the nation into sorrow. Booth came down the steps of the dress circle slowly and patiently. He had about 90 seconds now. He looked down at the little white door leading to the presidential box. The chair in front of the door was empty. The presidential guard, John Parker, was still at a nearby bar, swilling down cheap ale. For the first time, Booth knew he was going to get into the presidential box without trouble. In the box, President Lincoln sat relaxed in the red velvet chair, still holding his wife's hand. Lincoln gazed down at the stage thoughtfully, unaware of the dark figure creeping up behind his back. Booth walked down to the white door and stood with his back to it. He studied the faces of the people nearest him. Some returned his glance, then turned their attention back to the stage. Less than a minute remained now before Booth would strike. A wave of laughter shook the audience as the play unraveled.
No heir to the fortune, Mr. Trenchard?
Oh, no.
What? No fortune?
Now was the time. Booth knew that in a few seconds there would be but one player on the stage to block his exit. He turned the knob, pushed open the door, and walked into the darkness. Taking a pine board, he wedged it against the back of the door and put the other end into a niche in the wall he had carved earlier that day. Now, no pursuer could follow from that direction. Booth moved toward the second door, the one that led to Box 7. He glanced through the small hole he had drilled in the door. His gaze fell upon the back of the president. Booth eased a 6-inch Derringer pistol from his coat. It contained one ball of shot, which is all he would need. It was aimed directly at President Lincoln, who, in seconds, would be an inert figure. Down on the stage, the play struggled onward.
It all comes from their barking up the wrong tree about the old man's property.
Augusta, to your room.
Yes, Ma, the nasty beast.
I'm aware, Mr. Trenchard, that you are not used to the manners of good society.
Booth braced himself. His finger began tightening on the tiny trigger. He leaned forward.
The manners of good society, Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, you sock-dologizing old man-trap.
During that period of raucous laughter, a lead ball left the barrel of a tiny Derringer, held in the hand of a man who crouched in darkness inside Ford Theater. That was on this night, 100 years ago. This night, 100 years ago, President Abraham Lincoln is spending his last night. Tomorrow night, we will conclude the drama, the story of one of history's most infamous crimes, the men who lived it, the people who perpetrated it.
I'm telling you, you little fool, I must have broken my foot jumping from the box. Give me some of that whiskey. Let's get out of here.
But, John, what about Lincoln?
Have no fear. The Colossus of Rhodes will speak no more.
Tomorrow night, we enter the Black Night, Lincoln's last evening on Earth, on the 100th anniversary of his death. These are the last days of Lincoln.